I'm Heather Vale, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Gwen Harvey, Executive Director, and Kathleen Miller, Founding Director of Living Grace Homes. The organization's annual Glitter, Glamour, and Grace Runway Luncheon is coming up in November. Thank you both so much for being here today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Yes.
So, first of all, Kathleen, what is Living Grace Homes?
Oh, it's a wonderful program. Living Grace Homes has homes for pregnant and parenting moms who are homeless or in danger of being homeless. And they're residential homes that provide a safe haven from life storms, allowing moms to make the changes that they need to make to get back on their feet and become good moms and good members of the community.
Awesome. And Gwen, why is this organization important for our community?
It serves a need in our community on so many different levels, with these young ladies being faced with the lives that they've had in front of them and having to make a choice over putting a roof over their head and being able to keep and have their child is not a decision that a woman should be faced with. And we provide that roof and a path to independence from there.
Yeah, that's awesome. How many young mothers do you think you've helped so far since the beginning of Living Grace Homes?
Just a little over 900 moms have spent part or all of their pregnancy at Living Grace Homes, and we've had almost pretty close to 900 healthy babies as a result.
Wow, that's great. And how long are we talking about that Living Grace has been around?
So we opened our doors in February of 2007. And we opened our second home in March of 2014.
Wow, okay. So tell us about the upcoming Glitter, Glamour, and Grace Luncheon.
The luncheon is one way to give to our organization in a fun and festive way. It is before the holidays this season, and we have fashions featured by Anne Fontaine, and a lovely lunch provided by the Ahern, which is where we're hosting, and an afternoon to come and see what we do ground floor up, who we represent and who our clients are, and to get to know our organization and enjoy your afternoon at the same time.
Nice. Okay. So you've got a lunch, you've got fashion show. What else is going on during the event?
There'll be both a silent auction with some fun packages and baskets that might be just what you need to look for your Christmas shopping, as well as a live auction of a week in Hawaii and working on the airfare to go along with that. So it is a fundraiser, and it's a good way to see what we do and be a part of an organization that will really change lives.
Yeah, that's great. So it's taking place at the Ahern Luxury Boutique Hotel. When exactly is this going on?
November 7th from 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. I believe the doors will open at 11 so people can come in and peruse the silent auction items, but they will also be available for those that register ahead of time. They'll get in either a text or an email allowing them to go on and look at the items that they want to bid on.
And you mentioned it's a fundraiser. What exactly do the funds raised go to support?
The funds raised go to support both the housing, transportation, the staff that supervises and provides that transportation, and just the overall running of Living Grace Homes to provide these roofs over their head.
Okay. What is the Safe and Sound Campus?
Great question.
Yes. A few months ago, the opportunity to close on a property that is expanding our beds, expanding our scope of clients, and being able to continue to fill a void in our community. The campus is adding approximately 34 more beds, and it will allow us to serve young ladies over the age that we currently serve, which is 14 to 24. We have multiple calls at least daily for women that are over that 24 years of age that are in need of assistance. And we are going to be able to expand our scope and invite in young ladies of all ages and assist them in getting them set up near off the streets and into independent living.
And in addition to transportation and housing, we're going to be able to provide on-site counseling services to help them deal with the traumas that they've experienced that led to their homelessness.
That's awesome. So, will this be the third location then?
Yes.
Third location, yes.
How many beds total do you currently have?
Currently, we have 10, and the number of beds, because when we do head counts, we get to count the children involved as well. So we are tripling what we're able to serve right now.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Okay, so what opportunities do you have for community members to help out, whether it's as a volunteer, making a donation, anything along those lines?
Endless.
Well, the first donation area is the Grace and Hope Club. And then, Gwen, go ahead.
So many opportunities. We have had multiple cleanup days. This property is over 2 acres and gets to have a lot of TLC going into it. So whether it's blood, sweat, and tears, helping with intake of the donations that were given, actually providing donations towards the end of the year, we accept a lot of Christmas presents that we get to wrap up and deliver to the young ladies, in addition to food donation, clothing donations, toys for the youngsters. So that volunteering, donations, financially, as Kathleen mentioned, we have monthly packages, we have other campaigns, even a sponsorship for the Glitter, Glamour, and Grace that we have coming up. We have a few of those sponsorships still open up.
Awesome. Okay, so where can listeners go for more information about Living Grace Homes and what you do to apply to be a volunteer or to get tickets to the Glitter, Glamour, and Grace luncheon?
Directly to our website, livinggracehomes.org, has access to all of it there.
Perfect. All right, so once again, the website is livinggracehomes.org. Livinggracehomes.org. You can find out more about Living Grace Homes, the work that they do in the community. If you'd like to make a donation, if you'd like to apply to be a volunteer, you can do all that there as well. And if you'd like to get tickets to the Glitter, Glamour, and Grace Luncheon, once again, that's coming up on Friday, November 7th from 11 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. at the Ahern Luxury Boutique Hotel on West Sahara Avenue. And you can get that information there as well. Living Grace Homes. Homes.org. And we've been speaking with Gwen Harvey, Executive Director, and Kathleen Miller, Founding Director of Living Grace Homes. And Gwen and Kathleen, I really appreciate you both being here, letting us know more about this amazing organization, how you are helping young women in the community who are experiencing homelessness. And the annual Glitter, Glamour, and Grace Runway Luncheon sounds like a lot of fun and a great way to get involved with the organization. So thank you so much for sharing today.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks so much.
You know what hope is? Hope is action, carving a path forward, even when it's hard.
And kids who still know how to dream. They're the best pathfinders of all.
So at Child Fund, hope means helping millions of children living in poverty worldwide to grow up healthy, educated, skilled, and so all those good things can come true for them. Safe.
And that means safe at home, safe at school, and safe online.
Hope means walking this path together, all of us. Because when we work together, we can do so much more.
That's right. Hope includes you.
Child Fund, because we need each other.
To learn how Child Fund works with children in 23 countries to help them achieve their full potential, visit childfund.org. That's childfund.org.
This is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and joining me is Dr. Prudence Hall, gynecologist, leading expert on menopause and holistic hormonal health, and author of Radiant Again and Forever, Overcome Menopause and Restore Your Radiance. October is Menopause Awareness Month, and Dr. Hall has some natural ways we can deal with our body's changes. Dr. Hall, thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much, Heather.
So what's your book, Radiant Again and Forever, about?
I was working a lot with Suzanne Summers when she was alive, and we did lots of interviews back and forth and discussed each other's work. And she said, Prudence, you have to write a book. I said, "Oh, Suzanne, I'm so busy seeing patients and so busy running this center and everything." She said, "Well, that's too bad, but you have to write a book because if you don't share your knowledge at a certain point, it's like grapes, it's going to rot on the vine." I said, "Well, what should I do?" And she said, "Well, each chapter should be a different patient. And you can, the first chapter can be menopause and perimenopause, then thyroid problems, then sexual problems with women, and just go through the list and use a patient. You know, make sure they're real patients and you're inviting the listeners into your consult room to hear what it feels like with menopause and all the problems that can arise from that, and then how you treat the situation, and then follow her and what happens to her." So I did that, and she wrote the foreword, and I give the book away for free. People can get it at thehallcenter.com and just put in their email address, and we download it to their email. And I wrote it to help women because that's why I'm here at this point as an elder in this field, is to really share my experience as a doctor for 40 years with people who are just entering into perimenopause, which can happen at 35, 36, 37, maybe all the way up to 42. And then menopause that starts very early too, around 42 to maybe 48.
Yeah, so let's just clear up some confusion potentially. What is perimenopause and what's menopause?
Oh, those are good questions. So as we age, all of our hormones start to decline. So around the age of 35, estrogen starts to decline, testosterone starts to decline, human growth hormone can decline. Also, the thyroid, which is located in the neck, can start to decline. And we call that stage perimenopause. The ovaries are still making some hormones, but they aren't making the same hormones that we made at 20 or 25 or 30. So let's say that a woman's estrogen level on day 8 of her menstrual cycle, the period is day 1 of the cycle. So let's say on day 8, let's say it's normally 175 to 200. So in perimenopause, it might be 100 or it might be 85. And sometimes women won't ovulate each month. So it's not very, very consistent. Periods can start becoming irregular. And as the estrogen declines, all kinds of symptoms start to rise. Now, menopause is when the ovary stops making any hormones. And that is sometime around the age of 44 to 48, maybe 49. This is 10 years earlier, Heather, than it used to be when I started 4 decades ago. So this is quite a bit earlier, and that's due to toxicity and stress and high sugar in our diet and lack of sleep and, you know, a lot of other things. But perimenopause just becomes menopause. So it starts where the hormone levels are just fluctuating and then it tanks and we have no more hormones left, which is a real problem for women.
Yeah. And then does menopause last for the rest of our lives after that?
That is absolutely correct. You just won the big bonus surprise here because so many women say, "Oh, I'm going to get through menopause. It's going to be okay. This is just a 5-year period that I have to go through feeling so miserable and horrible." But unfortunately, once menopause starts and once we're in menopause, it lasts for the rest of our life unless we correct our hormones and optimize our hormones using natural bioidentical hormones. So women really are misinformed about this. And I'm always saying, Heather, how you manage your menopause will affect the next 40 or 50 years of your life and the health that you're going to have during that time.
Yeah, wow. Okay. So obviously, menopause happens when we're older, but how does menopause itself age us further?
Oh, this is your questions are great. So, when estrogen is low, 4 of the primary root causes of disease rise. So, when estrogen is low, up goes stress in the body, inflammation in the body, high sugar, and also high LDL cholesterol, plus the subparticles that cause heart disease. That's ApoB and Lp(a). Those all go up. So, what increases when estrogen decreases is heart attacks, strokes, diabetes, Alzheimer's disease, all kinds of neurodegeneration, hypertension, all kinds of cancers, all kinds of autoimmune illnesses because stress, inflammation, high sugar, high cholesterol, and you know the bad cholesterol, those all contribute to chronic diseases of aging.
Okay, so what are some natural ways to deal with and manage menopause?
Okay, so the first thing is you want to have a relationship with a doctor who understands menopause and perimenopause. So a lot of times women will go to their doctor and say, "Yeah, I'm having night sweats, I'm more depressed, I've gained 15 pounds, my brain is more foggy. Oh, help me." And they'll suggest the birth control pill. This would be to a woman who's maybe 37 or 38. So that is incorrect. That is I would say, a much less than adequate way of dealing with perimenopause. So first of all, you want to find a doctor who's going to check your hormones and who knows how to interpret them. So be your own advocate with your doctor. Say, no, I think I'm in perimenopause. I'm in the age. Don't let them say you're too young or you're too old or whatever, or those are not the symptoms. Really get checked. And then make sure that they are willing to check all of your hormones. So it's not just the ovarian hormones, and those hormones would be estrogen, progesterone, testosterone, and then also this thing called the follicle stimulating hormone, that's a pituitary hormone. So you want them to check those four hormones, but you also want them to check the thyroid, the adrenal stress hormones that rise and fall according to the stress that we're facing. And also the sugar level and the insulin, that is a very important parameter of menopause. It goes up in menopause, and all diseases rise when the sugar levels go up. So someone who really knows how to manage this, and it's not always easy to find a gynecologist that knows how to do this. But I think that this field has tipped. In the beginning, when I was in the field, I was pushing and, going on all these shows and talking about it and trying to educate people, or educating people about it. And then about, I would say, Heather, maybe about 7 years ago, everybody's saying, "Oh, hormones are important. We need to optimize and replace our hormones when they start to decline." And to me, that is just music. That other people in quite a, I would say, organized group of people are now saying how important it is.
Yeah, that's great. Now, just to take a step back and look at that standard advice of birth control for a second, doesn't that regulate estrogen, progesterone, and testosterone?
I wish it did. What it does is it can regulate the period. And by the way, the period is not the way to determine if you're in menopause. Many women come to me for their first visit and they say, "My periods are absolutely regular, but they're deep, deep, deep in menopause, according to their labs and their symptoms." So it'll regulate the period, the birth control pill does. But I've measured hundreds and thousands of women on the birth control pill. And what I find is that estradiol levels are greatly suppressed. It also suppresses testosterone levels. And it also, well, we know that there's increased heart disease and increased other, like blood pressure in some patients. So rather than curing those, or rather than giving a solution to keep blood pressure and heart disease and stroke low, actually with the birth control pill, those are slightly elevated. We don't want to have any elevation at all. So it actually hurts women's hormones. And when I see women who have been on the birth control pill for 20 years, those hormones are, they're not beyond help, because every single woman can be helped, but their hormones are very, very irregular. So I always am telling women, please don't take the pill in terms of trying to balance your hormones. There are a lot of much better ways of doing that.
Yeah, okay. Now, you mentioned weight gain. So, how can we keep from gaining weight during menopause?
So the first thing to do is to replace the estrogen with bioidentical hormones. That's either cream that's made in a compounding pharmacy, or it could be with the patch that pharmaceutical companies make that is also excellent, and to bring those levels much closer to youthful levels than to menopausal levels. So my goal is to turn back the clock in terms of our hormone balance, and that absolutely allows women to lose weight. Especially if I add thyroid and adrenal hormones, if those are abnormal or low. And it also it gets rid of the symptoms, which is very important. So weight gain will happen when women go into menopause. It could be 10 pounds, but I frequently see women who have gained 50 or 60 pounds. So once I balance those hormones, and once I correct their diet and help them eat a lower carbohydrate diet where they're eating, I mean, this is a whole nother topic, is how to eat, but we want to keep our insulin levels very low, because when insulin levels are low, that's when we're burning fat. If we're constantly eating or snacking throughout the day and we're eating higher carbohydrate food, that'll raise the insulin level and that causes weight gain. So menopause raises insulin levels and raises sugar levels, and correcting the hormones to more youthful levels will lower that. And it really is very effective in terms of lowering weight, especially when you sleep 8 hours and then want to exercise and do smart exercise along with that. It's a total body makeover.
Wow, that's awesome. And will that also help bring us back to our youthful radiance that we used to have?
That is the goal. And I would say that most of the time, women tell me, people are asking me if I've had a facelift and what have I done? And I've lost 20 pounds and I look so much better and my hair is growing and I'm not looking haggard and tired. So hormones bring back youthful physiology. Now, physiology means the actual chemistry of our body. So we build muscle mass. We stop losing bone density. We build our bone density and we really change how we look and how we feel. So the answer to that would be a resounding yes. Hormones can turn back the clock in terms of multiple different factors. And above all, I don't want women to have symptoms. Symptoms are, depression and anxiety and fears and not being able to drive because they're frightened and terrible hot flashes and sleeplessness. These are all very, very common. Weight gain, of course, and I would say despair and not even knowing who we are. Women get very disoriented in menopause, and it's very common that women come on and say, I just don't know who I am anymore. I used to be really loving and I loved my partner, my husband, and now I don't even like him and I don't want to make love with him anymore and I'm afraid he's going to leave me. And it's a very stressful time. But out of this stress can come, it's like the phoenix coming out of the ashes. We create our lives. We create our purpose that gives us a passionate presence in life. And as we become an elder, but the body still stays youthful, we can be in service to so many people who need us. And that is a sure way to stay happy, to be in service to others.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, what if we just want to increase energy? What are some lifestyle shifts we could do?
Well, first of all, sleep. Sleep 8 hours, and melatonin is a helpful hormone for that. I usually start my patients on any place between 3 to 10 milligrams. I start low, so I start at 3 milligrams and I say 5 milligrams. Also, GABA, GABA, helps women to sleep. That's about 500 milligrams. I have a supplement called Sweet Sleep that mixes a bunch of stuff together, but you can also get some good products like this online. So get 8 hours of uninterrupted sleep, maybe up to the bathroom once to urinate and then back to sleep. The second thing is to eat correctly. So when you eat a carbohydrate-rich meal, such as lunch that has sandwiches or pasta or bread or potatoes or rice, that's going to raise our insulin levels and we're going to feel really sleepy. In menopause, the thyroid gland, which is a very important gland that gives us energy and runs our metabolism, helps us lose weight, or when it's low, makes us gain weight. That is an energy endocrine gland. So when the thyroid is a little bit low, we're going to feel tired. So in order to make your thyroid function better, you can have 3 or 4 Brazil nuts a day. That has a lot of selenium in it that the thyroid gland needs to make thyroid hormone. And also, you can take some iodine. So there's crow's, Lugol's, which is a drops that you put in water or just drop into your mouth and then drink. In order to make thyroid hormones, you need 4 molecules of iodine. So some selenium from Brazil nuts and a little bit of seaweed salads or seafood that has a lot of iodine in it, or just taking a supplement of crow's Lugol's iodine, which is on Amazon. It's online. You can get that. That will really help you with energy. There are a lot of other things that can cause fatigue. So I'm always looking for, are there any underlying chronic diseases that can cause fatigue? And when the adrenals are low, fatigue is enormous. Women tell me, I can't get off the couch. I'm so tired. So those adrenal glands sit on top of the kidneys. And when we're stressed, they pour out DHEA, pregnenolone, cortisol, adrenaline, and we feel more energetic. But after we've been stressed for a certain amount of time, those glands get tired. and they can't continue to make those hormones. So the levels drop and drop and drop, and we call this burnout. It's commonly, that's not a medical term, obviously, but that's just, how are you doing? Oh, I'm burned out. I'm burned out. That means I'm extremely tired. So I help the patient, the client, to replace those hormones, pregnenolone, DHEA, cortisol. Those are the three hormones that I replace mainly. And their energy starts to increase, and with the sleep and with the decreased carbohydrates and with walking after meals, which is great, or some form of exercise after meals, insulin levels stay low. So that also helps tremendously with increased energy.
Wow, okay. Now, is there enough iodine in iodized salt to accomplish that, or would that just make it so we'd have to eat so much salt that it causes other issues?
Thank goodness they, I have iodized the salt. That's a good thing that that happened. But we don't begin to eat the iodine that Japanese people, for example, eat, which is about 12 milligrams per day of iodine. And to really help the thyroid to function, we can either eat seaweed salads every day, that would be helpful, or different types of ocean plants like algae and things like that. That helps. But I think that it's not so natural for Americans to eat that. Now, I take care of people in every country in the world practically, and some countries really have plenty of iodine and they don't need extra supplementation. But a couple of drops of iodine a day are very, it's a very helpful way to make sure that the thyroid gland is getting enough of that material it needs to make healthy hormones and to maintain youthful levels.
Awesome. Okay. So this is a fascinating topic, and obviously there's a lot to it. So where can listeners go if they'd like to find out more or download that free copy of Radiant Again and Forever, Overcome Menopause and Restore Your Radiance?
Yeah, well, I'm on various sites. I'm on YouTube and Facebook, and so I'm interviewed quite a bit, and I love to be interviewed. So thank you, Heather, very much for bringing this information to your listeners. And the website, thehallcenter.com or Dr. Prudence Hall, you can download the book there, and it's free. I wrote it with love for all of those sisters out there of mine that are struggling. So I look forward to meeting some of them and offering advice if needed.
Yeah, that's fantastic. All right. So once again, the websites are drprudencehall.com. You can find out more about Dr. Prudence Hall and all the work she does. You can also get the book there, or thehallcenter.com. There's more information there as well, thehallcenter.com, or find her on YouTube, Facebook, listen to her interviews, watch her videos. Lots of information that Dr. Hall is sharing that can really help, especially women as we get older. We've been speaking today with Dr. Prudence Hall, gynecologist, leading expert on menopause and holistic hormonal health, and author of Radiant Again and Forever, Overcome Menopause and Restore Your Radiance. Dr. Hall, I really appreciate you being here. It's been such amazing information. It's always great if we can take the natural approach to health, and you've given plenty of tips even right here. And I know you have a lot more in your book and on your websites. So thank you so much for sharing these tips, especially for Menopause Awareness Month. But of course, menopause is something that happens all the time to women all around the world. So thank you so much for sharing today.
Well, thank you, Heather. It was really a pleasure talking with you.
As you age, you may have questions about finding transportation, healthy meals, or other services around your home and in your community. And the Elder Care Locator has the answers at 1-800-677-1116. Our caring advisors can connect you to trustworthy local experts and the support you need to age well at home. Real people, real assistance, and real connections are just a phone call away with the Elder Care Locator. 1-800-677-1116.
Parkinson's disease affects around 8.5 million people globally and is expected to double by 2040. It's estimated that Black and African Americans make up less than 8% of all clinical trial volunteers. The Michael J. Fox Foundation is working to change that, and today we are talking to Alyssa O'Grady, VP of Clinical Research, and Michael S. Fitz, a patient advocate, to talk about myths, facts, and the importance of brain health at every age. Thanks for taking the time and being with us.
Thanks for having
Thank
us.
You.
Alyssa, let's start with you. Why is studying brain health so important, and what factors have contributed to the underrepresentation of Black Americans in Parkinson's research, and how has this affected outcomes?
Parkinson's disease is a brain disease that can cause movement symptoms like shaking, slowness, and stiffness. And Parkinson's can cause non-movement symptoms like mood changes, thinking problems, and sleep issues. Listeners may be surprised to learn that Parkinson's disease is the fastest growing neurodegenerative disease in the world. The Michael J. Fox Foundation is the world's largest nonprofit funder of Parkinson's research, and we're on a mission to find a cure for Parkinson's and to accelerate the development of better treatments for those living with Parkinson's today. The way we get to better treatments and a cure is through research, including research that will give us a complete picture of the disease itself in people of all racial and ethnic backgrounds. However, research studies face a chronic shortage of volunteers across the board, and less than 8% of study volunteers identify as Black or African American. There are several barriers that have contributed to studies disproportionately excluding underserved groups, including simply getting community members to understand what research entails and what they can do as participants. We're committed to changing this picture because we can only get to a cure that will benefit every person with Parkinson's if we study people from all communities.
Michael, it's time to hear your story. As someone living with the disease, tell us about your experience receiving a diagnosis and what are some early signs that you may have experienced or even missed?
Okay, thank you for that question. I received my diagnosis in 2011 at the age of 38. At the time, I was still working full-time in academia. So I can truly say that when I finally got my diagnosis, I was in total shock. Total shock because of my preconceived ideas of what Parkinson's looked like and what group of people would be affected. It really didn't occur to me that it could affect a African-American in his 30s. It just caught me off guard. So one of the things that really struck me is that while I was going back and forth to the doctor, I probably had gone 2 years just off and on trying to figure out what was going on with me. I was having certain symptoms such as drooling, loss of smell, stiffness, difficulty swallowing, diarrhea, and sleep difficulties. So there was so much going on with that. And so I kept going back and forth to the doctor, and they were doing so many tests on me. And finally, after I got diagnosed, I asked for a second opinion. He told me that I could get a second opinion, but they're going to tell me the same thing that I told them. So going through that was a really, really, really challenging part of my life. So it is just difficult to articulate. I apologize.
Thank you so much for that. Alyssa, back to you. Are there some signs our audience would be surprised to hear about? And how is the Michael J. Fox Foundation studying brain health through landmark initiatives and research?
Michael's story really highlights how important it is to have the information and awareness on some of the early signs and symptoms of Parkinson's so that we can take charge of our own health. Many people aren't aware that getting older, having a family member with a brain disease like Parkinson's, losing sense of smell, acting out your dreams, and other factors can increase your chances of developing the disease. Something else that Michael's story highlights is how we desperately need better ways to measure Parkinson's and better tools for diagnosing Parkinson's. Nobody should have to wait 2 years like Michael did to get an accurate diagnosis and explanation of what's going on in your body. The way that we get to better ways to measure disease and better diagnostic tools and eventually to better treatments and a cure is through participation in research. Studies like the Foundation's Parkinson's Progression Markers Initiative, or PPMI, and the Black and African American Connections to Parkinson's Disease Study, or BLACK-PD, are leading to major advances in understanding of Parkinson's disease. And both studies have opportunities for adults of all ages to get involved, whether you have Parkinson's or not. The first step is going to michaeljfox.org/participate to learn more about your role in research and how to get started.
Alyssa, thank you so much for that. And Michael, back to you. What do you hope the audience learns from your story and this type of work being done toward better treatments and a cure?
Hopefully there's a story or something that we've said here today that'll help somebody and encourage them to go to the doctor and to see if they're having some challenges, especially some of the symptoms that we're talking about, because sometimes they're hard to, match them with something. But I would also encourage people to be diligent as far as their health is concerned. Be your own advocate. There's nobody that's going to help you like you can help yourself. So I would just encourage people to do that. And I would also say to visit michaeljfox.org/participate. There's so much information on the page, and you're bound to find something that will help you.
Thank you so much for the time today and for everything that both of you are doing.
Ever lose your keys? Is that normal aging, dementia, or something else? Fear often stops us from asking for a simple checkup from the neck up. Knowing your numbers, blood pressure, blood sugar, and cholesterol are common, but your cognitive numbers are also important, especially if you're age 65 or older. Better to act sooner rather than later if you want to maintain or enhance your brain's health. Hello, I'm Kevin, president of the Dementia Society of America, a national nonprofit organization. I'm excited to offer you a free guide filled with tips for better brain health and important facts about dementia, care planning, and much more. Go to 1-800-DEMENTIA.org or call 1-800-DEMENTIA. Your brain will thank you.
I'm Heather Vail, and you're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Dr. Jacob Sands, thoracic oncologist at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, along with Wendy Brooks, small cell lung cancer survivor. Thank you both so much for being here today.
Thank you, Heather.
Thank you.
So first of all, Dr. Sands, what is small cell lung cancer?
Small cell lung cancer is a kind of lung cancer that tends to be more aggressive. It spreads earlier and it can spread more rapidly. Thankfully, we have an array of different treatment options and advances in the field that are really helping us in this fight against small cell lung cancer.
Okay. Do we know what causes small cell lung cancer in most cases?
Well, there are a lot of different toxins that can cause small cell lung cancer, smoking being the most common, and part of the reason that lung screening is so important to catch lung cancer early.
Okay. You mentioned there's a lot of treatment options. What are some of them?
Well, right now we've had a longstanding treatment of chemotherapy that's been present for decades at this point. A little over 5 years ago, we had the involvement of an immunotherapy drug, started with the chemotherapy as the initial treatment for small cell lung cancer. And that immunotherapy has made big differences for a subset of individuals. And I'd say to the extent even where we have some patients that I think might be cured of their incurable disease, it's that big a difference. About 5 years ago, we had a new drug called lurbinectedin, another kind of chemotherapy that was approved. And just last year had a type of immunotherapy drug called tarlatamab. This is a drug that helps the immune system fight the cancer cells. And it's the first in a class of drugs called T-cell engagers. But on top of that, we have an array of different treatment options available in clinical trials that have been quite promising. And I'd say we have more drugs right now that are promising in trials than the culmination of everything up to this point. Just to highlight the importance of being evaluated and understanding your treatment options that are available in clinical trials.
Yeah, okay. Wendy, what's your story with small cell lung cancer?
So my small cell lung cancer was discovered in July of 2023 after my sixth annual low-dose CT screening, which was so very important to find this because I did not have any symptoms. I was at risk. My father had passed away from lung cancer in 2013, 10 years prior to my diagnosis, and I had environmental exposures through work and radon in our home that I grew up in, as well as uranium contamination. So I had quite a bit going against me. I worked with my primary care physician to petition for the lung cancer screening, and that's exactly what caught it, and I believe that's why I'm here today talking with you.
Wow, that's fantastic. Now, Dr. Sands, Wendy mentioned not having any symptoms. So if that's the case, how is small cell lung cancer detected and diagnosed?
That's right. The majority of people don't have symptoms until it's really widespread. And this is why getting lung screening done is so important, even without symptoms. So if you qualify, talking to your primary care doctor about a CT scan, it's easy. There's no pokes. You lay on a table for 2 minutes, and that's essentially it. And this is a way of looking for nodules in the lungs to hopefully diagnose it early.
Okay. Now, you mentioned clinical trials. What do you tell your patients about joining a clinical trial?
So there are various common misconceptions about trials. If I can just highlight, it's often people think that there's a possibility that they would get just a placebo. That would never happen. Also, I think sometimes people think, oh, the trial is just to help give a forward that maybe people in the future will benefit. But any trial is something that we discuss for that individual. What is the best treatment for them? And in some cases, there are such promising treatments in clinical trials. It is a potential option to get a treatment of the future today. And so it's about what is the best treatment for that individual. We're still entirely focused on what's best for them. But what's going on in trials is so promising, given how fast that the science is moving, that there are important considerations for each individual to weigh in. Now, tarlatamab, I mentioned, that's that immunotherapy that was approved last year, has been a really important advancement in the field. And I have people that have been treated on this class of drugs for years that they had only available on clinical trials. That drug is now available as standard of care. But there are other things now that are available in clinical trials that are not yet available as a standard of care. And so for each individual, we weigh that out. What's the best option for them, based upon the specifics of each of those options?
Okay. And Wendy, what's your experience as a clinical trial participant?
It's been a very good experience. I'm actually on my second clinical trial. My first one I started after my disease progressed or came back from my first line of treatment. And I was on that therapy for 10 months, and it was one of the newer therapies, the antibody drug conjugate therapy. And it controlled and it reduced my tumor size and kept it from spreading for 10 months. And when I started to have a volume increase in the tumor, we pivoted and went to a similar tarlatamab type treatment, but not exactly that because it is a clinical trial. And I've been on that since January of this year. I am currently stable, and my cancer is contained, and I couldn't be happier.
That's fantastic. So, Dr. Sands, what questions should a patient be asking their doctor about new treatments?
Well, patients should feel comfortable asking anything that they think. And remember that this is all about you. So you ask anything that you want to ask. I think getting a sense of what are the different treatment options, what clinical trials are available. If you're not at a center that has trials, I'd really strongly encourage you to go to a center that is accessible to you, that has trials available, just to talk about these, to know, you know, what are your options. Because if you haven't met with someone in the region that has some of these trials, then, you know, you're just not aware of your full set of options. And then to weigh those out. At the same time, I think asking, well, what is the best case scenario with each of these? I would specifically ask that because I think oftentimes the conversation ends up being kind of preparing for the worst. But, you know, it seems like for perspective, knowing what are the good possibilities from this can kind of flesh that out a bit further as well.
Yeah, definitely. Wendy, what would you like people to know about your experience?
I think I'd like to let everybody know that being a participant in a clinical trial is a very good thing for you. If your oncologist is asking or presenting that information to you, to consider it. You're not a guinea pig. As Dr. Sands says, you're actually getting the science of tomorrow today. And it can help extend your life and allow you to enjoy everything that life has to offer.
Yeah, absolutely. Dr. Sands, where can people go to learn more?
So you can go to lcfamerica.org to find more information.
So once again, the website is lcfamerica.org. That stands for Lung Cancer Foundation of America, lcfamerica.org. And you can find out all about the latest treatment options and various types of lung cancer. And we've been speaking today with Dr. Jacob Sands, thoracic oncologist at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, and Wendy Brooks, small cell lung cancer survivor. And I really appreciate you both being here, Dr. Sands, letting us know more about small cell lung cancer and the treatment options, and Wendy for sharing your personal story with us. So thank you both so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Jamie Bowles, and I was diagnosed with non-small cell lung cancer in December of 2018. Nobody would even know looking at me that I have stage 4 lung cancer, and I'm grateful for biomarker testing for that. When I was sitting down with my oncologist, there was already state-of-the-art medication available that I was going to be put on right then and there. Ask your doctor how comprehensive biomarker testing before treatment may help you decide on the best treatment. Visit noonemissed.org to learn more.
A public service message from Longevity Foundation.
Federal guidelines have nearly doubled the number of Americans eligible for lung cancer screening. Insurance companies are required to cover these tests for those ages 50 to 80 who currently smoke or used to smoke. Along with new treatments, lung cancer screening saves lives. If you are 50 to 80 years old and smoke or used to smoke, talk to your doctor about lung cancer screening. For more information and to find a screening center near you, visit acr.org/mylcs. That's acr.org/mylcs.
You're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm speaking with Ahmad Hussein, founder and CEO of Defense Diagnostics, makers of Defent. October is National Substance Abuse Prevention Month, and fentanyl remains the deadliest drug in America. After losing his cousin to the opioid crisis, Ahmad developed Defent One, a pocket-sized fentanyl detection device that lets you test drugs before tragedy strikes. Ahmad, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for bringing awareness to this important topic.
Yeah, so first of all, why is fentanyl such an issue these days?
So fentanyl started getting introduced to the drug consumption world maybe 10, 15 years ago, but it became really prevalent during COVID when all supply chain was obviously disrupted during COVID. That included the drug supply chain as well. And that's when you started seeing a heavy amount of fentanyl being laced into all sorts of substances. Before, it was just in like the harder substances like heroin. And then during COVID, it started getting laced into counterfeit pills, stimulants, all sorts of substances. And that's when you really started seeing fentanyl overdoses being pretty prevalent.
Okay, so was it being used basically to cut more expensive drugs and just happened to be deadly? Or was it the intention in the first place to make a deadly drug?
The intention was to make a very cheap, addictive drug. So yes, it's the former. So to make it a more potent drug for a lower cost, and it's extremely addicting. So if they put a tiny amount and it's not enough to kill someone, oftentimes it is. But if it's not enough to kill somebody, especially if somebody has an opiate tolerance already, those people over time, if they're not testing their substances, they're not realizing they're accidentally becoming addicted to fentanyl.
Yeah. Okay. So what's your personal journey that led you to develop the Defent One device?
Yeah. So back in 2017, this is when the opioid epidemic became a public health emergency. And I noticed, you know, the amount of lives lost kept going up and nothing was changing. And in that time is when I lost my cousin to a fentanyl poisoning. And I do like to make it very clear of the difference between an overdose and a fentanyl poisoning. They're oftentimes used interchangeably, but I do think there's a distinct difference, which is somebody who overdoses, that means they're consuming a substance knowingly and they consume too much. A fentanyl poisoning is when there was fentanyl in the substance he was consuming and he was not aware it was in there. And I hear this story over and over and over again. We work with different nonprofits and pretty much every week I hear another story like this, that somebody consumed a counterfeit prescription drug that to them looked the same. They weren't aware it was laced with fentanyl. And if they just tested it, they would have known that there was fentanyl present and it could have saved their life.
Wow. Okay. So how does the Defent One device work?
Yeah, it's a pocket-sized device. It's designed to be used anywhere on the go. The Defent One took us 2.5 years of development, 57 prototypes to get this thing as easy to use as possible. It has a built-in measuring scoop. You take a tiny amount, say you're testing a pill, you wouldn't use more than 20% of the pill. You put it in the device, shake it up, and it'll tell you in real time. It's like a pocket-sized lab. It'll tell you in real time if there's fentanyl present. And, you know, in addition to the information about fentanyl being present, it also makes the user aware of the dangers of what they're actually doing. You know, somebody who's casually consuming a drug and now all of a sudden they're testing it because it might kill them. We have noticed it also changes behavior, the willingness to start taking drugs from random places.
Interesting. Okay. Now, a lot of people unfortunately deal with these types of tragedies, but They don't go out and make a device for other people. What prompted you to go ahead and develop this device?
Well, my background is in the diagnostic space, having the personal stories of knowing what that type of loss feels. Obviously, when you lose a person, that person is lost. But it's also, you know, the family carries that weight. And, you know, I've seen families torn apart after a loss like this. You know, there's a lot of regret. There's a lot of things that they wish they would have done differently. And knowing that the aftermath of what's left behind, I couldn't feel right to not try to make a step towards creating a solution. And I don't see anybody else doing it. Like, you know, like I said, we shut the whole world down for COVID because it was declared a public health emergency. But for the opioid epidemic, you know, everybody just turned the other way and acted and ignored it. And they just categorized, you know, these are just people who have drug problems, and they put them in a bucket. But that's not the case. These are everyday people. They're college kids, their brothers, their sisters, their blue collar workers, their service industry workers. It affects a very large percentage of our population. So I really just felt like somebody needs to do something about it.
Yeah, absolutely. So fentanyl has been used as a legitimate drug in the healthcare industry. What's the one main thing that the public should know about fentanyl and its risks?
Yeah, there's a huge difference between fentanyl administered by an anesthesiologist in a hospital compared to something created in a garage lab in Mexico and shipped over the border. All it takes is somebody does not have an opiate tolerance, a high opiate tolerance. All it takes is the equivalent of 2 grains of sand. And that's enough to kill somebody without an opiate tolerance. So it's extremely lethal. It's extremely dangerous. And it is found in substances that people are not thinking about. You know, people usually have their guard up when it's a party drug and they're looking to like get high and that's their mindset. But their guard comes down when they ask their friend for a Xanax or a painkiller. You know, they may be stressed or whatever their reason, they're self-medicating because it looks exactly like a pill that you can buy from a pharmacy. Unless somebody buys it from a pharmacy themselves, they need to test it.
Wow. Okay. So where can listeners go to find out more information about Defent?
Yeah, I recommend going on our website. It's Defent, like D-Fentanyl, so DEFENT.com. There's plenty of information. There's also our anonymous reporting tool. You could see people using our devices around the country who've been posting which substances they found fentanyl in. So the website's a great place to get more information.
Awesome. All right. So once again, the website is defent.com, D-E-F-E-N-T.com. And you can find out more information about the Defent One device and the other fentanyl detection products that are available, as well as information about this epidemic for National Substance Abuse Prevention Month during October and all year round, because this is not a crisis that's going away. We've been speaking today with Ahmad Hussein, founder and CEO of Defense Diagnostics, makers of Defent. Ahmad, I really appreciate you being here, raising awareness for National Substance Abuse Prevention Month, but also going on this journey and making a device that can help so many people and prevent so many other tragic deaths. So thank you so much for sharing today.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Thank you for bringing awareness to this important topic.
Charlie died after taking a single pill that turned out to be counterfeit.
He was having back issues, and it was a counterfeit poisonous pill.
Websites and social media selling fake medicines may look legitimate, but they're not. Drugs from these rogue pharmacies could have fillers like sawdust or deadly fentanyl.
He died in less than 15 minutes after taking the pill.
Now there's a free tool that can give you peace of mind. At safe.pharmacy, enter the pharmacy web address and you'll know if the site you're using is safe.
If you're not getting your prescriptions from a legitimate source, that next dose you take could be your last.
We just don't want other people to go through what we're going through. It's just horrific.
Go to safe.pharmacy. Find out about fake medicine on social media and if the site you're buying from is safe.
I'm Heather Vail with the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show, and this is your community events calendar for nonprofit initiatives and charity events around the Valley. Monday's Dark with Mark Chinook is a bi-monthly musical fundraising party at The Space, with each event raising $10,000 for a specific charity in 90 minutes. Upcoming shows include this Monday, October 20th at 8 p.m., benefiting the Roseman University Empowered Program, and Monday, November 3rd at 8 p.m., benefiting the Nevada Acro Foundation. Get tickets or find out more details at mondaysdark.com. That's mondaysdark.com. The Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department Foundation is holding their 12th annual Best of the Badge Gala next Friday, October 24th at 5 p.m. at The Wynn. Get tickets, sponsor an officer, or find out more at lvmpdfoundation.org. That stands for Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department Foundation, lvmpdfoundation.org. And Living Grace Homes is holding their annual Glitter, Glamour, and Grace Runway Luncheon, featuring fashions by Anne Fontaine, on Friday, November 7th from 11 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. at Ahern Luxury Boutique Hotel on West Sahara Avenue. Proceeds go toward providing safe shelter and support to pregnant young women and mothers facing homelessness. Get your tickets or find out more at livinggracehomes.org. That's livinggracehomes.org.